AI has the power to generate solutions, but if it's using unverified data, it could generate problems. Your business doesn't just need AI, it needs the right AI for your business. Introducing WatsonX, a platform designed to multiply output by tailoring AI to your needs. When you WatsonX your business, you can train, tune, and deploy AI all with your trusted data. Let's create the right AI for your business with WatsonX. Learn more at ibm.com/WatsonX. IBM, let's create.
Innovation Refunds does not provide tax or legal advice. We work with an independent network of tax professionals and will share information with them to evaluate and process your claims. Terms and conditions apply. Ty is a paid spokesman.
I'm Ty Burrell, actor and small business owner. You can trust Innovation Refunds with your small business's ERC claim because of their SOC 2 Type 1 security compliance. Without this, how can you be sure a company can protect your information? It's not like here on the radio, where all you need to be secure is a sensor button. My password to my bank account is Ty's cool password 1. Uh-oh. Luckily, Innovation Refunds is more reliable. Go to InnovationRefunds.com or call 1-843-REFUNDS to get started.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week, I have a friend of mine, Jonathan Miller of Miller Matrix is his blog and Miller Samuel is his shop. Jonathan has been an observer of the real estate market and industry for decades, literally decades. We met some years ago. I'm trying to remember if the first thing we did was a conference. We were on a panel with, of all people, Bob Shiller and Dottie Herman, who I believe was the head of Prudential Real Estate at the time. And it was 07 or 08. And, you know, she was the only one who was remotely bullish on the panel. It was Miller, Shiller, and me. And it was like bear, bearer, and bearist. It was pretty amusing. We've been friendly for quite a while. I find him to be really a unique set of insights into what's going on in the real estate market. What his firm does is gather data from around the country, very often in areas where there are no other form of data collection going on, specific data far beyond what we see from the National Association of Realtors or what the Commerce Department puts out about new houses. And he crunches the numbers and comes up with some really, really interesting perspectives. If you go to a real estate agency somewhere and they give you a tear sheet that shows you lots and lots of information about recent sales and length of time on the market and all that sort of stuff, his firm is the firm that actually collects that data, analyzes it, interprets it, and puts it out. He's got deals with a number of different companies. Really a fascinating approach to taking data and repurposing it in a way that's useful for consumers. I find him to be very, very insightful about all things real estate. He also has a column now. He puts something out once or twice a week on Bloomberg View in addition to what he does for his daily blog at Miller Matrix. Just an all-around nice guy and tremendously knowledgeable and insightful. The most fascinating thing, and I hope this came across in the interview, is he often gets tagged as an expert in divorce settlements and litigation and all sorts of crazy stuff. And I am not exaggerating when I say he's pretty much been in every single penthouse in New York City. Like, he's the go-to guy to appraise these $50 and $100 million properties. Not a lot of people with a deep expertise in that. And he could tell stories and actually has, and we touch upon it, about some of these apartments that are just unbelievable, just unbleeping believable. It's fascinating, and he tells all sorts of fascinating tales about where he's been, what he's seen, how stuff gets priced. Is there really a difference between $45 and $48 million? Turns out an extra bathroom here and a little bigger window there, worth $3 million. It's really quite interesting. If you are at all interested in real estate, and I am, and I assume many of you are, I suspect you'll find this conversation to be engrossing. Without any further ado, my conversation with Jonathan Miller.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
Today, I'm actually thrilled to have an old friend in the studio. You may not have heard him directly, but you've probably read a quote of his in the New York Times or anywhere else somebody is talking about real estate. Today I have Jonathan Miller, founder and CEO of Miller Samuel. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here. And I have to say, Barry, you have a great voice for radio.
I have a face for radio is what you're really trying to say. So for those of you who really don't know who Jonathan is, he's fairly legendary in the world of real estate. I think that's a fair statement, right?
Well, at least in my own mind.
And you're a legend in his own mind. If you're in New York real estate or a few. So let me back up and give your CV a little bit. So you started out in this industry as a agent and then an appraiser.
I've been a real estate appraiser since the mid-80s.
All right. And what kind of set you apart, I want to talk about three things so people know who you are. First, you were one of the first guys in the real estate world, and this sounds insane because you would have thought this was going on for decades, who said, hey, all these transactions are generating a lot of data. Why don't we take this data and take a closer look at it and see if we can discern any sort of meaning from how long a home is on the market for, what it sells relative to its asking price, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. No one was really doing this before you came along.
Not really. Most of what was being done was a marketing brochure.
Right, nonsense.
Or very complicated in the sense that it was sort of academia.
Right.
And it was hard for the consumer to digest. As journalists say, the trend, three data points make a trend. And then I like to say the trend is your friend.
Right, except for that bend at the end.
Until it ends.
Right.
Right. The bend at the end. I like that. That's even better.
So that's my contribution to... You know it's true if it rhymes, right?
Right, absolutely.
So the second, so assembling the data was the first thing you did. And then, miraculously, you were an objective commentator, observer. You know, I used to mock relentlessly the National Association of Realtors.
David Luray, the chief economist, right? It was painful.
Just everything out of their mouths were just horrific marketing spin.
Well, you have this dilemma. So in real estate transactions, you have this... If you look at the broad view, you've got at one end of the spectrum, you've got the real estate community. It's always a good time to buy.
Or sell.
Literally, right.
That was literally an ad they put out in the midst of the housing collapse. It's always a great time to buy or sell a house.
Right.
What that really means is it's always a great time to generate a commission-based transaction.
Right.
And P.S., my mother was a real estate agent. This was...
Right.
Dinner conversation. So I'm not bashing real estate agents.
Oh, no.
As an outsider, this was literally what I grew up with.
Right.
So when I mock these people, it's from the inside, not the outside.
Right, absolutely. And then the other end of the spectrum is the academics, you know, the Case-Shiller index, mm-hmm. and all the problems of that and what the purpose of it is. And we've really positioned ourselves somewhere in the middle, which is essentially in the trenches providing sort of on the ground observations about the market. And one of the things that I found really fascinating being an appraiser was during the whole big sort of housing boom run up credit bubble back starting circa, I started seeing it in 2003, 2004. No one else was talking about it. And I thought it was really bizarre.
You were out in left field. And in fact, to emphasize your data slicing skills, so first, the data runs that you put together, actually, it's a feed into Bloomberg. So if you're on
yes.
the terminal,
yes.
I don't know what it's called on the terminal.
Yeah, we have a Manhattan Luxury Price Index. There's three different metrics that are used. We also have a luxury rental price mm-hmm. index. And
I've also seen your specific regional housing data.
Yeah.
Here's Nassau County. Here's parts of Florida.
Right. We
Miami,
cover 18 different markets. So we cover a whole bunch of markets in New York City Metro, four markets in South Florida. And then I'm now starting to develop research in Los Angeles. So
right.
It's amazing because
I'd love to see the San Francisco area.
Yeah,
also.
That would be. I was approached about that, but nothing has come to it yet. But what's amazing about it is the concepts of supply and demand. They don't change all that much. I mean, the numbers change. How many zeros
right.
are after it?
I'm amazed what you get in L.A. for a couple of million dollars versus what you get in New York.
Right. Well, you always
get a lot of house in that.
You always see the celebrity, you know, a Johnny Depp or whoever. It's like, oh, they sold their palatial estate for $3.5 million. And I'm thinking, that's a large two bedroom in Manhattan.
Right. It's not a big
That is
deal.
Not a prestige play.
Speaking of which, I said there are three things. The third thing, which is we'll get to, you've been in pretty much every penthouse in Manhattan. Is that much of an overstatement?
I have. One of the most the greatest experiences is seeing these insane penthouses. The
fully
designs
decorated, fully decorated.
However, what I don't usually get to see is them in the evening at night. It's always during the day, so I don't get to see them with all the lights on.
That's
in
a shame.
The city, which is, you know, half of the
spectacular
aspect of the view. But we see, and you know, that in itself is a whole different submarket of the housing market. You're seeing
which
that,
has held up really well.
Which has held up really well.
Yeah, because the money is almost an afterthought. It's irrelevant.
Right.
Yeah, I'm going to buy this because I can and I don't care.
Well, the whole, just to digress to the whole phenomenon of this high-end aspect is it's a global phenomenon. It's not just unique to
New York. London, it's Hong Kong, it's Shanghai,
it's
you know,
Sydney,
going to any major city, it's booming because there's a boatload of money. We're talking real estate with Jonathan Miller, CEO and founder of Miller Samuel. Let's hold off on discussing the penthouses just for a few seconds. I want to talk for a moment. I want to pick your brains for a moment about what it is that drives most of real estate. We put together, so we were talking about this, we were putting together a list, and it was everything from demographics and household formation to interest rate to wages, but really, all of this comes back down to credit, doesn't it?
It really does, and that's actually one of the key components. If you look at the bulk of the housing market right now, it's really defined by access to credit. If you look at, you know, I always like to say housing is local and credit is national.
That's right.
And so literally, you know, post Lehman, credit crunch, every market started behaving the same way. We had things like rents rising because people were tipped back into the rental market because they couldn't qualify. We also had inventory begin to fall to record lows nearly universally across all housing markets because a homeowner with lower negative equity, which is roughly about 40% of all homeowners with a mortgage, don't qualify for that next purchase, either a trade-up, a lateral move, or a downsize. So what do? They sit. And they don't enter the market organically the way they normally would bring their house to the market. And then people that don't have a credit condition are saying, well, I can't find the house I want, so I'm not going to list my house. And you sort of double down on the problem. And the only way out of that is twofold. One is housing prices rise, which naturally occurs because
as a function of tight supply, not necessarily strong demand.
Correct. And or strong fundamentals either. It literally is you constrain the supply, prices rise. And that's been my biggest criticism of the pronouncement of a U.S. housing recovery as early as 2 years ago, because the fundamentals in terms, you know, income's generally stagnant in the U.S. Unemployment, even though the numbers on the top level look good, it's still not good. And credit is about as tight, at least for residential mortgages, as it was in the days following Lehman. So I never thought in my career that I would be saying that tight lending conditions are making housing prices rise.
But they are.
But they really are.
It's a combination of tight lending conditions following a boom and bust in real estate, because you end up with a lot of people who don't have any. Look, under normal circumstances, you're in a house for 7 years.
Right.
Even if you have tight credit conditions, you should have some equity in the house.
Right.
But if you bought at the peak before a 35% correction, if you put little or no money down, there is no equity there, and that locks you into that house unless you're just going to walk away. And if you do that, good luck qualifying for a new
house. And I think that, you know, the narrative about housing right now is this idea that, you know, is the housing recovery losing steam? You know, are we seeing, you know, projections for housing price increases are going to be less this year than they were last year? Well, last year was based on artificial conditions. I almost see 2013 from the context of the U.S. housing market as really an anomaly. In other words, in 2000, 10, 11, 12, we had this pent-up demand, the election cycle, the build-up to the fiscal cliff. The world apparently didn't end after right. the fiscal cliff expired. And there was all of a sudden a concern about rising interest rates because the economy was going to get better.
Right.
And you had all the fence sitters moving out of their...
The tax change as well was another factor.
The tax change was certainly, well, on the high end of the market especially. And you had people rush in and you still had the low inventory
issue.
So you had prices rise. Now we're doing these year-over-year comparisons, and activity or prices, if they're not above last year, it's somehow a failure or a sign of weakness, when I contend it's the wrong comparison to make.
It absolutely is. We're discussing real estate in America with Jonathan Miller. So now let's talk a little bit about the high end. We understand what's constraining everybody's houses, the normal, I don't even know what to call it. The median house is about $207,000.
Right, it's right, exactly.
Somewhere around that. And, you know, obviously it's really regional. $207,000 in the New York metro area doesn't get you a lot. One of the people in my office.
It gets you a closet in a hallway that you're going to buy from the co-op to combine with your apartment.
One of the people in my office transferred here from Syracuse. They sold a house for $107,000. And I'm like, what is $100,000? I don't understand. You look at a picture of it.
Right.
It looks like a regular little, you know, a starter house, a ranch. But it would go for three and change here. So when we talk about normal housing, what is the story? What should we expect in the near future from this housing market? Has the death of housing been exaggerated?
Yes, absolutely. I think all it is a reset from the euphoria that we had last year, which was based on nothing, I like to say. It really was based on this horrible skew created by tight credit. We're already seeing a spread or a widening in general between the higher end of the market and the balance of the market. In the context of the credit conversation we're just having, because
it's a cash transaction.
So as you move up in price, there's a higher probability of either a more cash paid or just all cash outright. You also have the preference by foreign or international buyers towards the high end. They're global investors,
mm-hmm.
Urban markets along the Eastern Seaboard, on the West Coast, very similar phenomenon.
That's L.A., San Francisco, Seattle, Vancouver.
Right.
Even up into Canada.
Absolutely. Very similar. And that's a key driver. But other is that we're seeing a disparity between conforming mortgages through the former GSEs versus jumbo, right?
Mm-hmm.
That banks like jumbo mortgages. They make money on them. They want to. So the business decision.
Wells Fargo is what? They like own the jumbo mortgage market, don't
right,
they?
Right, right. They're a huge lion's share of the market nationally. But any lender right now is looking to do jumbo deals because they make a favorable return on it, and the alternative, the GSE related transactions, which is 90% of the mortgage market,
right,
is still burdened by, in many ways, the credit outlook within that realm is very backward looking. It's looking at the transgressions. The conservative element is from the transgressions that were made several years ago. The Department of Justice going after banks for bad lending practices, all those sorts of things. So it's very backward looking, whereas I think the jumbo finance arena is very much more current looking.
Today we're discussing real estate and housing with Jonathan Miller. Earlier, we were talking about the difference regionally. How have these recoveries differed? You know, I know South Florida is different than Arizona, is different than Las Vegas, is different than Southern California, which is obviously different than
sure.
Silicon Valley and Northern California. How do these different regions compare? And what does that mean for someone, let's say, living in New York or Washington, D.C.?
Well, when you look at a lot of the national housing metrics, and you look at the comparison by city, and you'll see generally what you see is markets that were hit very hard, probably the hardest, were the markets in the what FDIC calls the sand states, the Las Vegases of the world, essentially, where there was tremendous amount of speculation, carpenters and nurses quitting their jobs and becoming real estate speculators. And so they fell much harder and farther And, you know, the way I like to describe it is when you go from $1 to $2, it's 100% increase. So the metrics in terms of showing their increase made them look like, wow, they're really recovering much more quickly than other markets like New York, for example, that didn't have the speculation
right.
that you saw in these markets. So it's really almost an apples and orange comparison. What you're seeing now is the markets that are seeing rapid price growth, some of them, like a Las Vegas, the rates are cooling rapidly because they've essentially recovered a lot of the almost overcorrection that had occurred right. in those markets.
And this is a lot of low-hanging fruit.
Whereas markets where the economy's very fundamentally very strong, they didn't have a lot of speculation. You had talked about it in an earlier segment about someone from upstate New York and how much they got.
Right.
There are markets in the country that didn't experience the same boom and bust
cycle. Neither the up, neither the down.
So they're not going to rise from the ashes because they didn't really fall to the
right.
ashes.
You right. know?
So I think the rule number one is there is no national housing market. In the way that it's presented to us every month with all the reports,
all the data,
and
right.
and secondly,
to be fair to Case Shiller, they do release their 20 and 40 metro region housing prices, and then they jumble them all together. In
right,
the
and have
index.
A 20 city index.
Right, so when you look at the individual index, you could still see, and there are a number of people who then take the Case Shiller data and slice and dice it nicely, and you could see. A couple of weeks ago, I ran two different charts. I forgot who I stole them from. One showed the percentage recovery off the lows and how far they still have to go to get to the highs. And they were like Las Vegas was in both. They were crazy. Wow, we're up 80% off our lows, but we're still 97%.
But
crazy
remember,
numbers.
But remember, the high point that was reached was complete fabrication.
Right. Nonsense.
It was based on nothing.
Gossamer.
Right. It was based on.
They were building these exurbs in Las Vegas, these big McMansions that was a 2.5 hour drive from any urban center, any job
right.
center. So, how are you going to support these homes if it takes you, whatever, 4 hours round trip?
Because what was driving the demand was. Lenders were just looking to lend. That was how they made
That's
money.
Right.
They'd package up the mortgages and sell them off to offload the risk to somebody else. We're not in that world anymore.
That's right. The shift in credit, and I've written about this over the years, went from the borrower's ability to service the loan to the lender's ability to sell the loan to a securitizer.
Right.
Once that shifted and the borrower's ability to service it no longer mattered, hey, it was just a matter of time before it collapsed.
Right.
So now we talked before briefly about other regions. Texas is an unusual region. I don't think a lot of people realize why Texas avoided the boom and bust. There was a change in their constitution, I think it was like a century ago, where they are not allowed to do cash out. No cash out refinances.
Right. Right.
It's against their state constitution. So everybody maintaining their falling income, replacing it with HELOCs and borrowing.
Just financing their day-to-day. When you run low on money, you just borrow more because housing prices always go up.
They always go up, right.
The other quirk in Texas is the idea that the transactions aren't publicly recorded. So any studies that are done come out of the realtors, which is really a subset of the public record to begin with.
Right.
So it's not a full data set. So you could almost argue too that ignorance is bliss.
Right.
That the market wasn't fully informed of.
So if I use a Zillow app and show me what's sold nearby in Texas, I'm not going to see the same thing that I see anywhere in. Listen, I'm
not necessarily because the information isn't, it's a non-disclosure state. So,
Are there many non-disclosure states?
I don't know offhand. I want to say there's about a dozen.
Okay. Today I'm speaking with my friend Jonathan Miller of Miller Samuel. He is an expert on real estate, appraisal, transactions, home values, etc. He has crunched a lot of data over the past few decades about what drives housing. And one of the things we really haven't talked about much, but I want to discuss is the international component about this, the international buyers coming here to North America buying up real estate and the booming real estate markets we see in big cities overseas. So where do we want to start with that?
Well, we'll start with the basic driver of it is I'd like to say that global real estate, or specifically luxury real estate, high-end real estate, in the context of a worldwide context, is the world's new currency. In other words,
you don't need Bitcoin, you just need a really nice apartment New York and London
for a nice, $80-90 million price tag. So what you're seeing is across, and this has really been a phenomenon that's virtually exploded in the last 3 to 4 years, is you have a lot of concern with wealthy investors in terms of exposure to higher taxation as governments grapple with weakening or challenging economic conditions, political turnover. So you look at Europe, for example.
France is a perfect example.
Tremendous, pressure for government shortfalls. Where do we get the money from? Limits on compensation for securities industry, all sorts of things. And then just on top of that, a higher regulatory overlay for, many of the wealthy that have their own businesses. You start looking around the world for maybe other places to diversify your net worth, and one of them, it could be pork bellies, but one of them is real estate, and real estate, ironically, New York is very favorable in the international environment, since we're sort of the starting place for a lot of what's wrong with the world right now in terms of credit problems.
So cash is king here.
Cash is king. And not only that, but it's really I think the terminology here is this global safe haven, that what you're looking for is people. I like to say that we're building the world's most expensive bank safety deposit boxes, where you where you put your valuables in it, like your artwork and whatever else, and then you rarely go back. And there's a lot of that going on here.
You've been in a number of those apartments.
Oh, absolutely.
You?
And I don't know what mistake I made in my career path, but but I'm not going to own one of those, at least.
Is that necessarily a mistake? You have a very lovely home in Connecticut. And it's certainly not a $100,000 ranch. It's a little bit nicer than that.
Right.
And so most of us are not going to be in a $50 or $100 million penthouse. In fact, 99.9% of us are not going to be. And what you're telling us is even the 0.01% who can be in it, they're not even there.
They're not wasted views,
aren't they?
It really is. And the way you have to look at it, what I find almost humorous about the topic is when you'll see, for example, in London, there have been 3 transactions over $200 million.
That's amazing.
In the U.S., the 3 highest transactions, there was one for $147 million.
In the Hamptons.
In the Hamptons, there was another one in Connecticut for $120 million, and then there was another one in California for around $100 million. And you throw those all together and—
It's not even $1 billion.
It doesn't have anything to do with the balance of the market. It is more like a circus sideshow.
Right.
It's an anomaly. It has nothing to do, but what I think the real estate industry sees it as, and perhaps there's some truth to it, it's like, well, if someone's willing to invest $90 million in a condo that they're rarely going to use, that means they're very confident about the New York real estate market, and it's a good sign for everybody else. Maybe that's true. I can't.
Maybe they have $90 million. They don't know what the hell else to do.
Well, I think that's really what it is. And then what you're seeing is the other phenomenon you're seeing that's tied into this. Look at the regions. I talked about Europe. You also have China. You have the wealthy Chinese trying to extract their money out. There's a housing bubble there.
Get it out of China.
Right, to diversify around the globe, right? Australia's undergoing a siege of Chinese investors right now.
Sydney and Vancouver, I've always thought of as life rafts for the wealthy Chinese.
Absolutely.
Who are concerned one day they have to hit the eject button and get the hell out of Dodge.
And you have that in South America. The Brazilians have single-handedly bailed out the Miami housing market, which was a highly speculative market with 10 years of shadow inventory, inventory that was essentially just
dead,
built and can't be sold. And it's all been gobbled up. There's really none of that
left.
There were
like 100,000 condos.
It was a 10-year absorption rate. It would take conservatively to absorb, and it was done in 3 years, and it was primarily because of Brazilians and Venezuelans with the wealthy Venezuelans with the regime change were looking to get out. And so you see those phenomenons, but they have nothing to do with average American home buyer.
So if someone is looking to pick up a vacation property in Miami, not that I am, but if you were, has that window closed? Did you miss the bargain opportunity?
We're still seeing a fairly brisk appreciation rate, so there, I'm sure there's, you know, it depends, you know, every neighborhood, every market's a little bit different. What's interesting, and this is brings back to the credit discussion, if you look at Miami, which is a market that I prepare research for, about three quarters of all the distressed condo sales are cash.
Cash only.
Right?
Right. I knew you were going to go that way.
That's
amazing. 75%.
Well,
compare that to what the rest of the country is normally like. What,
right, right. Well,
30%?
Right, it's about exactly 70-30. If you look at the non-distress, meaning anything that's not a foreclosure or a short sale, condo market Miami, the cash buyers in that market account for about 75%
as much as distress, more than distress.
There's almost no difference.
That's amazing.
The variation, it varies every quarter, but the variation is 2, 3, 4%. It's really not a big difference, which means that it is a cash market. It remains a cash market. So guess what kind of new development projects are being built in Miami?
Luxury, appealing to international.
High end.
Yep.
A tremendous linkage with New York City. It's about the same time to fly to Miami as it is to take a car to the Hamptons, or not mm-hmm. quite the same, but that's sort of the
3 hours.
It's
sure.
seen as a competing element to it, especially markets like Palm Beach, which are almost all New Yorkers, very high end, very little foreign, whereas Miami is almost all foreign. So the cash, you can see, for different reasons, the cash element of real estate really, or the access to credit really, defines how markets behave.
That's quite fascinating. So we see foreigners coming to the U.S. and buying real estate. Is that what's driving things in London and Sydney, and where else is
it's
real
exactly
estate booming?
It's the same
like that?
Phenomenon. So in almost every major urban market in the world, you're seeing record prices. Incidentally, the high-end market in London is about 40% more expensive than the high-end market in Manhattan.
That's amazing.
So we're actually—
Why is that? Is it just a matter of not that much more space there? We're more vertical city, or—
I think there is less space there. I think that's part of it. Also, there's a closer proximity to the Middle East, to Russia, who, while they're touted here as big players in the real estate market here because they buy high profile, they're not even the top 20 for tourism.
That's
completely overhyped. The foreigners that are very active in the New York market and on the East Coast tend to be from Europe and the Chinese, or you know, Asia in general is probably the fastest growing contributors to the market.
There was just an article, you mentioned Middle Eastern money boosting real estate prices. It was just an article on Bloomberg today that talked about how the Dubai International Airport just passed Heathrow as the biggest international airport in the world.
Right.
That's just unbelievable. Dubai sees more traffic than London.
And that market is largely driven by speculation, you know, mm-hmm. that not in the context of the flipping
this house,
right? It's more of a long-term equity play. I think a lot of real estate investment right now around—
Is that speculation then, if it's a long-term?
It is speculation, but not in terms of— I think the way I discern from investment versus speculation is the time frame, the window. So, mm-hmm. for example, the time frame in the last housing boom that got the real estate market into trouble, the time frame was weeks, months, quarters. The time frame now is 5-10 years. It's a much longer window.
That's really an investment, isn't it?
It is an investment, and that's really what real estate has always been. We just lost our minds as a as a housing market during the last cycle.
That's quite
it's called a systemic breakdown.
I'm speaking with Jonathan Miller of Miller Samuel, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, there's a wall of quotes in your office when I walk in. Like, I have five things framed. I walk in, you have like a hallway with like 97.
Well, it was cheaper than artwork.
I guess it is. So we're talking about real estate, and you and I know each other for a long time. There's a couple of things I wanted to share with you that
sure.
we haven't caught up. So you know our house has been on the market
right.
for 2 weeks before we were
yeah.
sold. So someone said to me, wait, you sold your house in 2 weeks? Really like 7 to 10 days, but we had to wait for the contract to come
right.
back. So someone said, how did you price your house? And we had gotten a huge, this is like a middle class split level 500 and change new Long Island suburban
right.
bedroom townhouse, not a big mansion.
Nice
not
kitchen
a,
though.
A beautiful kitchen. I love our granite. I actually had an affair with our granite. That's a whole nother
is this
story.
Suitable for radio.
It is. I just fell in love with this granite and it haunted me for days.
Right.
And every other piece of granite just didn't do it. I know that sounds ridiculous. People don't think of me as a person in a kitchen stroking. Like, this is a nice piece of mica.
Right.
But this is... It's not my granite.
I have to say, it is a spectacular
it
kitchen.
It is a... That's another story. I could share the granite. So before I tell you how we sold the house, the granite story was we finally... So we ended up in a house by accident. It's one of these stories. We had a buy, and then we went and sold our house, and then we went back to our buy where we had an agreed deal,
right.
but we weren't in contract yet. And the seller had said to us, we decided we want $25,000 more. And basically it was like, well, wait, you told us we had to do this really quickly. So we cut our price significant. We cut our price 50 grand. That house also, first weekend, sold.
Sold.
And that was in the midst of the frenzy, so it was relatively easy to do. Say, hey, if you want the 25 more, that's fine. But then you get full price or you get fast. You don't get both. So if you want, I'll go break this deal and only cut the price 25 grand and you could wait 6 months and we could do it at this price. But you don't get both.
And what was the response?
Well, we won 25 more. By the way, the side note about that is they had $50,000 deposit on a house that their 6 month in their contract to close elapsed. And in order to not lose the 50, they had to come up with another 50, which is why they were pressuring us for the 25. We walked away from that. 2 years later, they got their extra 25, but they lost 100 to get it. And I remember saying to the agent, look, I know I have a facility of numbers, but you don't need to be a rocket scientist to know that 100 is a bigger number than 25. So that sort of stupidity is rife in real estate.
And here's the thing, and you made the comment, you know, we sold our house in 7 to 10 days, right? So what you're seeing now in the market in general, in many housing markets, is when a seller who feels very empowered because there's not a lot of supply
right.
out there, so they don't have a lot of competition, the notion that you sell in 7 to 10 days means to many sellers that the broker priced it too low or the seller priced it too low, they gave it away. When the
That's wrong.
But that is wrong. You're absolutely right. But that is an assumption because it's sold quickly. And I contend in this market, it's either priced correctly or it's not in the market.
Oh, it's incorrectly, right.
Right.
You see, these houses up for three.
It's
I love
not a
Zillow.
Dimmer it's not a dimmer switch. Right. It's an on-off switch.
So here's what I did in order to price the house. And understand, we found a house that we fell in love with. And I'll spare the grisly details, but it's a divorce and it's a little complex. And it's a nicer house on a bigger piece of land in a nicer town right next to this big preserve. So I'm paying a couple of bucks more for the set. But that house was on the market. We haggled over the price when they priced it too high. It had been on the market for almost, I think, 300 days. We're a live one. Oh, look, we got someone interested. It's a contemporary house. You have to either like that or not. So I know it's kind of a little bit of a niche.
Right.
And it's an odd price. It's not one of these big multi-million dollar houses, but it's not a $500,000 house. And so it was a weird house. And so our concern was, hey, we don't want to lose the house we want to buy. So we're not going to give our house away, but we're not going to try and squeeze.
Right.
Sometimes getting every last penny is expensive.
Right.
So here's what I did. I love the Zillow app. We've talked about this. We've both been on our boats in the Long Island Sound using the nearby button on the Zillow app to look at all the prices of the houses that are either for sale or sold that are waterfront, and it's mind-boggling.
Right.
When I've been in the harbor by Port Washington looking at Kings Point, these houses are $14 and $16 million.
Right.
Like the co-ops and condos that are $100 million, that's made up. Those are just, that's just not real. But an $8, $10, $12 million house, that's like a real number because there are $3, $4, $5 million houses.
Right.
So I used that Zillow app and I said, show me every house that sold in my town with this many bedrooms, three bedrooms, two baths, this much, you know, and then I looked at them and I said, everything that sold at or above my price point, you know, I was looking for the price where everything was either much bigger or nicer or waterfront or something that made it special and where that line was. And then I looked at everything that was sold and it was either not as nice as our house. You know, we gutted the whole house and completely and there's nothing, you know what has to be replaced? The garage door. That was we ordered one. It never showed up. Never paid for it. That's literally the only thing that we didn't turn over in the past 7 years.
And what you're describing is you're describing the aggregation of real estate information.
Yes.
Right to the consumer. And so it's very different now. What's interesting, when I was talking before about the buyer saying, or rather the seller saying, oh, I sold it. I priced it too low because it sold too quickly. What I also have seen through, you know, decades of looking at transactions and appraising is that if you overprice, you'll ultimately end up with selling your home for a lower price than if you had priced it very close to the market.
Because it gets stale.
It gets stale. That's a reality of it. And I think a lot of sellers don't get that. And
the agents lose interest. It's just you see it on what they're. That's a nice house, but what's wrong with it?
Well, think of, you know, a lot of people, you know, on one hand, we have all this great transparency. But on the other hand, you're conveying a disconnect with the market. You're saying, I don't know what's going on. This is what I want. So the buyer's thinking, well, this person is going to be really difficult to deal with. They're disconnected.
Right.
There's something wrong with the house that we don't know about. It's all kinds of red flags. And that slows down the market in terms of the interest of your home. And I see this over and over and over again. It's quite amazing.
So when I looked at the run of Zillow data, I said, when I put my house up for sale, there is not going to be a nicer house at this price point. In fact, everything else plus or minus $10,000 or $20,000 is not going to be as nice because I'm trying to look at it as a buyer.
Right.
Hey, if I'm trying to choose between this house for $599 and that house for $599, I'm going to go with a nicer house. And I also saw what sold within that price point. I have a feeling that $600 is a tough number to get over, because if you're a conforming mortgage,
right, you're straddling it. 625.5 is the threshold.
It's really tough
in our market.
It's really tough to sell something much above that. So, could we have listed it at 649 and maybe squeezed another 20, 30,000? Maybe.
Right.
But then
you lose the house that you're trying to buy.
And that's the whole point of this: is we want that house. So, you know,
it's called juggling, really.
When I started as a trader early in my career, I remember one of the head traders once said to me, I was trying to squeeze like the last couple of eighths, this is back in the days of fractions, out of a trade. And he's like, look, you could get out of this transaction a quarter point lower. Just hit the bid and move on. But I could squeeze a few more eighths out of this. He goes, hey, I remember this old guy said to me, hey, leave a little something for the next guy. And can I tell you something? It's good advice. If you're spending all this time and effort and energy to squeeze every last dime, there are a lot of non-monetary factors that go into the transaction, how smooth it is, how easy the people we're dealing with. He works at a finance company in New York. He's being transferred from elsewhere. They've been so far more or less a pleasure to deal with. And I can't help but wonder if I'm beating people up for that last $10,000 or $20,000, how much mental anguish is that going to generate.
Right, because the whole process is so emotional anyway.
It's surprisingly emotional.
It is, no matter what. And that was one of the problems during the last boom and bust cycle, was people are trying to view housing as a, you know, a stock or, you know, a commodity to trade.
But you know what?
And that's part of it. But the bigger part is it also has a, you know, a usage that
place to live,
part of what you pay for.
And it's an emotional. I recall the conversations I had with people in 06, 07, 08. I'm sure you went through this, where you're at a barbecue or a cocktail party.
Oh, that's all. That was the only conversation.
And neighbors would say to me, you know, I want to put my house up. And by the way, these numbers are real. That my house that I sold for five and change, people were selling for 7, 8, 9, which never 9, but 6, 7, almost 8. And I remember having a conversation saying, hey, the guy would say to me, the Smiths sold their house for $750. Why can't I get $750? We have a better yard, a better location on the street, a nicer kitchen. Yeah, but the Smiths sold their house 2 years ago.
Right.
That was 2 years. If you have a time machine, I promise you I could get you $750.
Right.
If you don't have, but I'm going to tell you, I know people who still own Yahoo. It traded at almost $280.
They're still holding it.
Right. It's 30 bucks. They can't get 280. You can't get 750. Right. You have to recognize the more. And then I would watch these people put houses up for sale, and they were always 6 months to a year behind the market. Well, so the market is at 600. They're at 700. The market drops to 550.
They're chasing it.
They're chasing it, but like on a year lag.
We had
never hitting the bid.
We had a situation in Manhattan, sort of the tipping point of the market, and the Manhattan market was about 2 years behind the national market. The national market peaked in the summer of 06. Ours was with Lehman in September of 08. Mm-hmm. And prices within the next 3 to 4 months fell on average about 30%.
That much, really?
Essentially, New York was late to the party, but we caught up real quick.
Right. And remember, most co-ops were requiring 30 or 40%.
The average co-op is 35% down.
That's a lot of cash.
So
that's a nice buffer.
So what we started to see is we started seeing people start to come out 3 or 4 months later to buy. And the broker feedback was, well, they're all low ballers. They're all offering about 30% below what it was 6 months ago. And my comment was, if the only people in the market are buying something for 30, only willing to pay 30% less than what it was before the Lehman event,
that's your bid, right? They're not lowballing. You're highballing the ask.
And
it's wrong.
And it was fascinating because the real estate community in general was more negative than the consumer.
Huh,
and it took them longer to sort of rebound because they were devastated, because the whole principle of property going up forever was shattered, essentially.
But, you know, especially here in New York. So I graduated grad school in 89. And unlike many of my peers who immediately ran out and bought co-ops and condos, 87, the market crashed. First thing new Fed Chair Greenspan did was cut rates. And you had a little boom in real estate in 88, 89. And then as rates kind of normalized, if you bought something in 89 or 90 in New York City, you did not get back to break even till, I want to say, 96, 97.
About 97,
like
right when the dot-com boom really started to kick in.
And we were just discussing this in the office yesterday. I remember that was still early in my career. I was on a sell side. I worked in a brokerage firm. And I recall hearing people say repeatedly, hey, I need 250 from my account. I need 180,000. I'm trading up. I'm buying a vacation property. I'm buying waterfront. And back in the 90s, $200,000 was a huge move. And
yes.
To go from 400 to 600 was a big move in real estate.
Absolutely.
Now it's another bedroom and a little bigger yard.
Right.
But in the 90s, that was like $500,000 houses were really nice houses.
Right.
Now it's a split level, you know, in a development. It's not a...
Right. And what the conversation was during the 90s, especially the early 90s, I know the market stinks, but I want to buy a house. I'm going to be
gotta
here
live
for
somewhere.
20 years.
Right.
And, you know, we're going to be here. This is our home. And so I think that's I think that's always the right approach. It has to be right for your situation. And I just was, I marveled at how we lost our way during this last go round. You know, really.
Well, you brought in 10 million people who previously did not qualify for mortgages.
Right.
That creates a huge, but it was more than clearly more than just that.
Right.
And so even, you know, some people have pointed to 97, 98 as the start of housing becoming unhinged. I look at that as just getting back to where it was in 89 and a tremendous amount of stock market wealth. It was just diversification. There were people who turned $500,000 into $5 million or $100,000 into $1 million.
Sure.
The numbers were just stupid. And so in terms of how many zeros are on your IRA doesn't affect your lifestyle. But moving to a fill-in-the-blank, bigger, nicer, closer to
certainly,
the water.
It certainly changes your attitude.
It's a huge lifestyle change also. You're no longer in the middle-class suburb you were. You're now in a whatever. And people love those trade-ups, which, you know, we started talking about this during the break and I want during the broadcast. And I've written about this. I know if you've written about it. I think all these tales of this is the end of real estate as an American pastime, I think that's nonsense. Wherever I look, I see people still in love with real estate.
So here's the thing. When you... What I find after a change, a condition where the market's either going up or going down, pundits, observers, participants in the real estate market think linear. In other words, when housing prices are rising, they're going to rise forever.
Right.
When housing prices
are falling, ad
infinitum, they're going to fall forever. When inventory is falling, it's going to fall forever. And there's
no
ebb and flow.
Right. There's no, it's not, it's cyclical. It oscillates. It doesn't project out.
Right. And so I find that all the time. And then, you know, the whole thing, and you and I have talked about this, the whole thing about home ownership and how it's declined. Well, it reached a point. Fannie Mae's stated goal at one point on their website was 75% home ownership in the U.S.
Which is,
we got to 69 and change.
Which is kind of ridiculous.
It's kind of ridiculous. And we're up from 69 was about 3-4% above what the 50-year normalized
right.
level was. And so now we're falling below the... you know, we certainly have been falling from the 69 level, and now we're sort of right in the middle of the long-term range, and it's continuing to fall. And the pronouncement is, well, we're going to be a nation of renters. And
no.
And it's a kind of a ridiculous argument.
It's as wrong to the downside as 75% was to the upside.
Correct. And really what it is, well, of course, homeownership is falling. Credit is historically the tightest it's been in the modern era. You have a weak economy. You have all these problems. That's why kids are living at home with their parents.
Household formation is at a low level, right?
It's not a lifestyle decision or a change. It's an economic decision because things are still not that great.
And let me tell you, by the time this airs, my house probably closed on, my mortgage with Wells Fargo either happened or didn't happen. But I've never experienced anything like the Wells Fargo jumbo investigation. I'm looking to see if I actually got an email from them right now. It's been pretty, pretty astonishing. The amount of detail that they've asked.
Did I ever told you my game show theory about banking?
No.
with lending? So think of it this way. This is how to explain the irrational behavior that when you interact with a bank to get a mortgage.
Right.
Look at a bank as playing a game show and let's make a deal, right? So door number one is borrow from the Fed for free. Grow other lines of business, rebuild your capital base,
right.
All those sorts of things. Anything but mortgage lending. Door number two is lend to Joe and Mary homebuyer for 30 years. Maybe one of them will lose their job. Maybe there's going to be a decline in their local housing market at some point. So there's risk, more risk associated with it. So
right.
They're trying to equalize the risk. I mean, this is very simplistic, but to try to equalize the risk between the two choices. Now, that now Joe and Mary homebuyer, 30-year mortgage is never going to be the same risk level as
a jumbo.
As borrowing from the Fed as a lender.
Right.
Right. So they're going to make them jump through hoops. And I contend it's not AAA. It's really quadruple A. It's irrational. It's irrational lending. And that's the condition. And then
is that our current condition? Are we in
absolutely.
A condition of quadruple A credit and irrational lending?
We have the cleanest mortgage product being created in the history of mortgages because lenders essentially, no matter what the ads say on TV, that's the sales side.
Right.
The underwriting side is afraid of its own shadow. And part of that is because of we're still under quantitative easing, although that's
right.
changing. But that basically
rates are still very low.
Rates
four
are
and
very
a quarter,
low. The
four
spread's
and
a little tight.
Right.
But also the economy is not robust. We're not seeing real strong income growth or employment numbers. You know, when you really break it down, so they're very conservative, and that's
conservative is one thing.
I think it's irrational. I think it's beyond. It's one step beyond conservative. It's irrational.
These guys have examined me so closely. My proctologist is jealous. So they've asked for.
They're looking for reasons not to lend to you. They
so
want
they've
no
asked
risk.
For. They've asked for 3 years of personal tax documents. They've asked for 3 years of business tax documents. They've asked for 6 months of corporate and personal bank statements. And I'm happy to give them.
Right.
And every now and then they'll say, what's this round number we see on the 15th of each month? Well, it's either drug lords giving me money or a paycheck. Which would you guess? By the way, you have the corporate account and the personal
math.
Account. You can match. Oh, you lost X here. You got X there. Do you think maybe that's a coincidence?
Right.
Or and some of the stuff. And,
it's called phishing. It's really, it's called phishing. It's essentially, they're looking for any reason not to lend to you.
To be fair to Wells Fargo, their staff has been phenomenal.
Right.
They've given us this checklist and they warned us. Hey, listen, by the way, this isn't a multi-million-dollar mortgage. This is barely more than a conforming mortgage, a little more. And the hoops they've had us jump through. The one house we looked at that was in danger of collapsing into the you saw that
right
house. Would have been double the mortgage, and the process was more or less the same.
Right.
And I'm like, this house is going to tumble into the sea, right? It's the risk isn't me, it's gravity,
it's
right?
The
you're
real
aware
estate.
Of that, right? So we submitted the last of the paperwork. They start processing it, and just before they submit it, they said, we have a question on your credit score. My credit score is okay. It's pretty good. My wife's credit score is phenomenal. And I said, well, what's the issue? You said I was above this cutoff. Well, over the past month, your credit score dropped 6 points or something. Could you explain this thing? And I'm like, I look at this. I'm like, I don't know what BEC, what is this? So they have to translate it into English. And it turns out we hired two new people. We bought two new computers for them.
Right.
And this was the Apple financing. And they said, oh, well, that affects your credit. I go, look, you guys see our balance in our checking account. We could have gone out and spent $3,000 on two new computers.
Right.
We could have done that 30 times over. But instead, the accountant said, hey, it's better for taxes to lease it than to buy. So we leased it for $135 a month. That's what caused a credit score on the owner of the company. The company leased this.
Right.
It wasn't
a big change in the credit score.
It was an insane. Yeah, but you go from whatever, 7 and something,
but that's
down 7 points. That's a percentage change.
That's the quadruple A standard that everybody's being held to, and that's the challenge. And that's what's defining the housing market right now.
That is. So I'm surprised if that's the case that any houses are getting. So, we're here in Bloomberg. I have a contract. I do a column for Bloomberg View. And they said, list all your sources of income. Well, here's what I get from speaking appearance. Here's what I get from my day job. And here's what I get
from the drug lords.
From Washington Post. And here's what I get from Columbia. And here's what I get from Bloomberg. And they're like, oh, well, it looks like it's the same amount every month from Bloomberg. Well, yeah, I have a contract. Can you send us the contract? And I had to ask somebody here, hey, am I allowed to show this to a, like, yeah, don't worry about it. But meanwhile, you're asking for a contract.
And it's going to be a 19-year-old in Ohio that's reviewing the document.
Right. It's a little more sophisticated than that, but not a whole lot more. And again, look, I've been one of the biggest critics of banks since the financial crisis. To be fair to Wells Fargo, they have been really extremely professional, very proactive. They would give us, it started out with this massive list. I'm holding my arms 6 feet apart. And each week I would get an update with, okay, these three items have been collected. Now we're waiting for these things. Because to gather all this stuff up, to get a P&L statement about two of the companies for the accountants, they're not going to do an audit unless we want to pay a boatload of money for it. And it turns out the words review are a term of art that implies an audit-like level of scrutiny.
Right.
So Wells Fargo asked for a review of the P&L, and the accountants turn around and say, these documents have been submitted in furtherance of federal tax filing. They appear to be in order to us. That's the most the accountants would. They wouldn't say we reviewed it.
Right.
They certainly aren't going to say we audited it. But apparently,
fear of risk.
Submission in order to of furtherance of tax filings was sufficient for Wells Fargo.
Well, think about that.
Crazy stuff.
So you have that whole interplay between the consumer and the lender. And then you look at the fact that, you know, with the uptick in mortgage rates over the last year, although rates
came back down.
They came back down. But
we're pretty close to the lows now, aren't we?
I think we're a half a point up, but
four and a quarter.
Yeah.
Were we ever really at 3.75 for very long? You were there for
a short burst.
We were there for 15 minutes and then it was
back
to four. I mean, that seems to be the floor. You're not going to break four.
And you look at that, which created a lot of, in many ways, sort of, on one hand, the spike in rates last year created this the surge, the last minute sort of gasp of air of getting mm-hmm. people off the fence. And now it's sort of framing the discussion about housing now, which is it's less than last year. But really, it's not really, from an historical context, it's no different. I mean, the rates are really nominally different. There's really no difference.
But a four handle is still an insane number.
But it actually feels tighter or weaker, and it's all from the credit orientation that mm-hmm. is driving what housing's
so
doing.
We really didn't get to what the proper role of government is in this, because some of the arguments that are being made is you have rates at record lows, but we have most of America unable to take advantage and refinance because either they lack the credit history, the income history. Amazingly, they're making payments on a house at 6%. Imagine if they could refi at 4%.
And then what that would do for the economy.
Yeah, that would be a huge, although you were effectively transferring some income from banks and giving it to everybody else. But the question is, what's the proper role for government in all this? And if Fannie and Freddie are ultimately on the hook, why not waive some of these requirements and allow refis? Because if they default at 6%, they're going to default at 4%, and they're less likely to default at 4%, so why not let them do a refi?
Right. I think the thinking right now, there's a lot of uncertainties about the former GSEs in terms of what their role is. They're going to merge them into one institution, but Congress doesn't have the will to do that.
What was that word you were going to say? The will to do that? Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. The problem is that it is a one-size-fits-all orientation in government in terms of risk. Mm-hmm. I think part of it is the austerity concern, or maybe that's window dressing on the problem. And so we're not giving anybody credit to be able to make intelligent decisions. We're really just saying we're not doing this and let the chips fall where they may. And it's a short-sighted solution, because like you said, there's lots of people with plenty of income. They might be low on equity and they don't qualify for a refi.
And yet there's an existing mortgage at that low equity level.
Exactly. Another component has been, and there's been discussion about it, is that the whole concept of principal forgiveness,
right,
you know, focusing on the the borrowers, instead of focusing on the making the banks whole, focus on Main Street.
Right, which so would make the economy whole.
Would make the economy whole, and then theoretically make banking whole. But we're sort of stuck in this box right now, which is, you know, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac are making a ton of money.
Mm-hmm.
It's highly volatile.
Mm-hmm.
It could turn on a dime. We're still dealing with the legacy issues of bad lending practices,
right.
DOJ going after everybody. We have the buybacks being forced on the GSEs. We have Congress saying...
Forced by the GSEs. Right. In other words, if you sold a pool of mortgages to Fannie or Freddie and there was some sort of misrepresentation, fraud, whatever...
It can be very slight.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's not just...
Because we know there was a ton of fraud all around.
Oh.
There was application fraud. There was underwriting fraud. There was somebody...
Appraisal fraud. There was, you know, liar loans, the whole deal, because it was just semantics.
I've gotten into arguments with some of my conservative buddies about the liar loans.
Yes.
And my argument goes something like this. You're the bank. It's your capital. You're lending it, right? You're the one who's taking the risk. It's incumbent on you to make sure that the person you're lending it to has an income, has a payment history, has a credit score. When you say, don't tell me that, what you're effectively saying is, I don't care. So to blame the buyers for, you know, look, we all know the story, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, what was going on with mortgage brokers. Here, leave that blank. I'll fill it in.
Right.
I mean, people signed it and... holding aside the bad behavior of the mortgage folks, if you don't ask for an income history, tax file, now this is the opposite of the proctology exam I'm going through with Wells Fargo. If you ask for none of that, by the way, we refinanced the house we're selling, I don't know, 2 years ago. It was more than fog and mirror, but not a whole lot more. And the house we had sold before this, I think we refinanced that 3 times over
right.
the course
I think
of 7 years.
I've been in my house for 10 years. I think every year, the first couple of years I had it, I refied like 4 times.
Yeah, it's the process was sign here, initial here,
simple.
Checks in the mail. It was insane.
Right.
So whereas it's gone to one ridiculous extreme now, we started an opposite extreme, but I hold the banks responsible. If you don't ask people, what's your income? What's your credit score? What were your tax filings? What's your payment history? How could you complain when they default? You didn't ask for that information.
Right.
You didn't verify it. Hey, by the way, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Give us a ballpark of
your
income.
They could package and sell off the risk to somebody else.
That's exactly right.
Who was unsuspecting, although
they knew.
But
they were more than unsuspecting. They were... Look, we're taking this risk and spreading it out. One of my favorite discoveries when I was researching Bailout Nation was
great
the
book,
warranty. was the warranty that came with these non-bank originated mortgages, primarily out of California, where these shops were.
Right.
Right. They gave a warranty that said this mortgage will not, this 30-year mortgage, this 360-month mortgage will not default for 90 days. And if it does, you could put it back to us. A toaster comes with a longer warranty than that.
Right.
Now, so how long did it take for the salespeople to figure out, hey, I'm not looking for people who could qualify for a 30-year mortgage. I'm just looking for some poor schmuck who's going to make the first 3 payments.
Right.
And by the way, the first payment is effectively waived. It's covered at closing.
Think about the...
So 2 payments and I'm out in 90 days.
Think of the irony of that, though. So during that period, mm-hmm. you had no credit standards whatsoever.
Zero.
Housing prices rose rapidly.
Right.
Fast forward to today...
Excess credit tightness.
The pendulum has overcorrected
mm-hmm.
to the opposite degree. Housing prices are rising, and in many markets at a very brisk pace. Credit is in play in both cases, but for completely different reasons.
So somewhere in the middle is the much healthier, slower growth, more reasonable housing market.
And that doesn't happen until you get real job growth, real income growth, not a booming, but just, you know, the whole notion that you actually have to have a job and have a reasonable income to qualify. When that, when those conditions improve, that's how you ease credit. That's how you get housing to be truly what I call recovered. All we've seen right now, I characterize as it's a rebound. It's essentially off of a low.
Right.
But there's
dead cat bounce, or a little more than that?
I think it's a little more than that, because, you know, there's so much psychological.
I love that phrase, by the
way. I know. We have two cats. I'm not allowed to say that phrase at home, but you know, there is some psychology to it. People not being afraid to venture into the market and buy.
Right.
But the problem is that it's everything's going to happen in slow motion, and we want quick results.
But that's not how the real world operates.
No.
You don't get that sort of stuff. So let's solve America's housing, credit, and economic problems all in one fell swoop. So here's what we're going to do. So we've noticed that Obama has essentially given up on Congress, who the day we're recording this, we see in a Gallup poll, is now down to a 7%.
Right.
A record low since Gallup started asking this question in, I think it was 1973. Record low. Not only is it the lowest Congress has ever been, it's the lowest any institution in America has ever marked. And so,
a notable achievement.
And so Obama has very interestingly said, I'm going to take a page out of the George Bush playbook and bypass Congress. And there's a lot of stuff I can do through an executive order. And so here's what I want to know. We know that there's a tremendous amount of economic activity and economic potential locked up in people who are stuck in their houses. We also know that ultimately Fannie and Freddie, meaning the taxpayer, is on the hook for those mortgages, whether they default at 6% or default at a lower rate. What would happen if the president said to the head of Fannie and Freddie, I want to institute a policy that allows people who are current on their mortgages, so we're not dealing with short sales, we're not dealing with underwater sales, to refinance at their existing mortgage amount or lower, so there's no cash outs, at the prevailing interest rate. I know in theory this may reduce the income to Fannie and Freddie, although there will be all these transaction fees that'll help them.
Absolutely.
What is this? A, can the president order Fannie and Freddie to do that? And B, what would that do to the U.S. economy and to the U.S. housing market?
Well, that's a sort
with
of,
a caveat that you're not an economist.
I proudly say I'm a non-economist.
Proudly.
So the new head of FHFA, the regulatory agency that oversees Fannie and Freddie, that was formerly called OHEO.
OFEO, right.
And they were asleep at the switch.
The whole run.
The whole run.
Worse than asleep at the switch, they're the ones who gave Fannie and the GSEs permission in late 2005. Hey, you're losing market share to Wall Street. You don't have to just do conforming loans. You could do non-conforming, meaning subprime.
Absolutely.
And Alt-A. And so 2006, Fannie and Freddie go headlong into that.
Right.
Just as the market is topping.
Right.
They might have been
timing
the
is
final
everything.
Spasm, and that was
And
that.
Actually, when they changed their name to FHFA, it literally was the same website, just with different URL. And the logos, everything was the same. So I never quite understood that, and I sort of feel like the rejiggering of Fannie and Freddie, if that were ever to happen, is going to be kind of the same thing. It seems like a can of worms. But anyway, I think that you take away income from Fannie and Freddie to give it to I think it's more important for the public to be on their feet and spending in a consumer economy than it is about worrying about whether Fannie or Freddie are going to make $500 million this quarter.
Right.
I think that's,
and ultimately that just comes back to the taxpayer.
It comes back
anyway.
To the taxpayer anyway. So I think that's important. We do have the head of the FHFA is much more pro-consumer in terms of their outlook and providing some flexibility, trying to give flexibility to Fannie and Freddie. So I think that's all good. I just, I haven't heard any overtures that the Obama administration would even entertain that.
Well, I haven't spoken to them yet. But once I plant this idea...
Well, I have full confidence that you could sell them on the idea.
I don't know if I could sell it, but it's a fascinating concept.
I think it's probably a good concept because so much of our wealth is tied up. People that are stuck, it's tied up in housing, and I think that triggers a lot of other things. The question,
mobility, it triggers real estate mobility, employment mobility,
yes.
Geographic mobility. That's a key thing. And I'm looking for the downside.
I don't think there really is any downside, especially from the naysayers. If you were ignoring principal reduction, mm-hmm. Principal reduction is sort of a hotbed
right.
of debate. I'm in favor of it.
We could hold that to
but
the side.
But if you
side,
put that to the side and don't even do that,
right? Just the people who are current have. Employed
who want to refi to a lower rate and nothing else changes.
Even if you have a $400,000 mortgage on a house that's worth $350,000, does it matter if the interest rate to the note holder if it's 6% or 4%? It shouldn't make a difference. So there are people who hold the securitized notes. They have to expect a certain amount of maturation that happens normally.
Right.
This is going to be a huge shift. Now, in theory, it creates a whole bunch of new paper that Wall Street can then move about and sell to these people. And if you want to hold on to whatever you have, you can hold it. The way this gets called is kind of complicated.
Yeah,
it's
the pushback
balance.
Will be from the investors that were
right.
expecting a 6% return
right.
and now
well,
it's
you know
suddenly
what?
4%.
I'm sorry that you're going to have to get a less of a return like everybody
but
else.
But you're probably reducing dramatically the default risk.
That's right. That's the trade-off. You're getting a lower default risk because people can afford it, and you're helping the overall economy.
Right.
So I've been playing with this idea. I'm looking for a downside to it, and other than the fact that people hate government intervention, but there's an article in the Times today by Neil Irwin.
Yes.
Talking about, formerly of the Washington Post, talking about the import-export bank. And how certain people hate it because it's government in bed with big business. But the reality is that's the nature of industry globally.
It has to be.
That's what's going on. Listen, if the European banks are subsidizing Airbus, how can the U.S. not allow Boeing to compete on the same playing field? And if you don't do that, what ends up happening is they lose – the battle.
They lose all the big contracts.
Right, to Airbus because it's subsidized.
Right.
The ironic thing is the jackasses who are opposed to this are Delta Airlines because, by the way, worst airline on the planet, run by morons. I can't begin to tell you how much I despise that airline.
Really?
My least favorite airline, search the blog, searchredholtz.com for it.
I hope you're not an advertiser.
You'll see, I don't know and I don't care to tell you the truth. But here's the amazing thing. Delta opposes it because they say, oh, you're subsidizing Boeing sales to competitive carriers overseas, and that's not the government's role. Hey, morons, Neil Irwin points out, you guys were rescued in a government bailout.
Of course.
So just sit there and shut the hell up.
And take it.
Or, right. It's like, so you got yours, and that's the end of it.
Right.
Nobody. Of all the hypocritical things, I don't know if they're more hypocritical than they are a lousy airline,
right.
But those are your choices. Most hypocritical company in America, worst airline in America.
Right.
So that's this message is brought to you by Delta. Fly Delta and maybe you'll make it there. I just had a couple of really bad experiences with them. Other people disagree with me about Delta, but
I actually rarely fly it. So
I don't fly it anymore. And I'll never forget, I was flying to Atlanta to give a speech. I got booked first class. And they do what a lot of legacy airlines do, which is
yeah.
when they don't have a full flight, they cancel it. And they roll you into the next flight. And I'm like, listen, I got to be somewhere at 6 o'clock tonight. I know your cancellation was nonsense. So they give me, we'll get you on this plane. And I go from 2A to 26B, which is the 26.
The middle. In
the middle
the
from at back by the bathroom.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm sorry. I had a first class ticket. Why am I? And the woman says, well, A, you didn't have a first class ticket. You had a 6GY ticket. And B, that's the only seat we, you know, that's all we have at this time. So I'm like, let me, I just have to stop you there. I don't know what a 6GY is. When I went on to Delta.com, your choice is either
first slash business class
or economy. And there was like a $600 difference in price. So I don't know how what 6GY is or whatever the code was, but you give me two choices, business or coach. I pick business. Is there an empty business class seat? I would like to have it. And at that point, it's like I had to get down there. So I get on the flight. To add insult to injury, there's an empty seat in business. And then to make matters worse, when I call Delta to say, all right, I bought this ticket for whatever, I'd like a refund of the difference, they proceeded to explain to me that they couldn't tell the difference in price. Let me stop you a sec. I work in finance. I could tell you the price of any of 10,000 stocks on any day for the last 100 years at any second of the day. Your own tickets. You can't tell me what the hell these are selling for? I bought it. You could see the day I bought it. What were you selling the coach tickets for?
Right.
Just refund me the difference. And I said, you know what? And they refused to do it. They actually sent me a certificate for $250, which when I went to use 7 months later was expired. So I said, you know, my penalty for this is one day I'm going to have a radio show. And on that radio show, I'm going to tell people I love Virgin American Airlines, even though the last trip back from San Francisco, the seat didn't work, the juice didn't work, at the power on the,
right,
the electrical didn't work, the TV didn't work. Still better than Delta. And anytime if I have to fly JetBlue, JetBlue is always fine.
Good.
I get to sit in the front at Virgin, and JetBlue, it doesn't matter. You sit,
yeah, you sit
even more spaces, like $40.
Right.
That is the greatest air travel bang for the buck there is. Just those extra 6 inches by you
make all the difference.
It really does. So somehow the poor people on a treadmill listening to this, like, I thought we were talking about real estate.
Talking about housing.
This Ritholtz guy will not shut up. So let's bring this back to housing and what this means going forward. Assume the government does nothing. What is the no major?
How does this play out?
Yeah. What happens with Fannie and Freddie? What should the role of government be?
Right.
And what do we do with this? What? How does housing manifest itself over the next couple of years?
So I think that housing will follow the path of what the economy does. In other words, I think when we see real improvement in the economy, and what I mean by that is simply more real job growth, I think that makes all the difference in the world, and that'll start to melt the problem.
A little wage increase as well.
A little wage increase, nothing huge, just improvement.
An uptick.
An uptick. I think, to me, all that matters are the fundamentals. This whole notion—
That's crazy.
This whole notion of, like, housing's going to lead us out of this.
No.
I feel it's just the opposite.
It always has been the opposite. And
but it's always stated as housing, you know, brings us out. It's always the economic sort of interpretation of housing is always how we get out of a weak period. And I feel I don't know where that math comes from, but in my experience,
it's wrong.
It's always backwards, because you actually have to have a job and have, you know, income prospects to qualify for a mortgage. So I feel it all goes hand in hand. On the more specific government aspect of it is that I don't think Congress has the will or the ability to make a sea change to what is responsible for 90% of the housing mortgages in the country. I think that is just a disaster waiting to happen.
Meaning what should they be doing?
I think they'll do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to
what would you want them to do?
I think what I'd want them to do. So what I've found is there has to be more awareness of sort of separation of church and state. In other words, for example, you know, the biggest culprits, one of the biggest culprits in this whole last down cycle were the rating agencies, mm-hmm. right? Where they are basically joined at the hip with the people that you know,
they were more partners with underwriters
right.
than
just
credible
like
analysts.
Real estate appraisers were joined at the hip with mortgage brokers, right? Find the right appraiser, make the number, we can do the deal, right? We have that whole, and then we have the revolving door between the regulators and private industry. So there's no real separation. And to me, the only way you reduce the, you'll never eliminate it because human beings are really good at screwing things up. Just everything sort of devolves into chaos over time. I think you're trying to reduce it. What Dodd-Frank does the wrong, sort of takes the wrong approach is let's regulate what happened in the past. And
But that's always true. Isn't every regulation backwards looking by definition?
Absolutely.
You know, it's amazing how well the formation of the SEC and Glass-Steagall worked from the 30s because it was backwards looking. But it was also when the pace of change was so slow.
Slow.
It was good for 75 years.
Well, that's
now, whatever you pass has got like an 18-month
That's part of my
window.
Problem with this whole notion of revamping Fannie and Freddie. When Fannie worked okay from the Depression up until...
05.
Right, up until 10 years ago, right? And so you have to look at what changed in 05, the middle
right.
of last decade, to make them implode and then eliminate that. That's the... We don't just because you put window, you know, new window dressing on an agency that's effectively going to do the same thing doesn't make the problems go away.
Right.
It's a waste of time.
You know, the Fannie and Freddie bashers always conflate two or three issues.
Right.
One is Fannie and Freddie was a horrifically corrupt organization who spread a lot of lucre around D.C. So
biggest supporters of public relations agencies, every agency in Washington had a Fannie Mae account. They were dominating.
They spread the money. Franklin right. Raines was not afraid to spend the cash.
Right.
And it was funny.
It was his expert accounting.
It was funny that I remember seeing guys like Newt Gingrich not complain about them. And then you find out years later, even though everybody thinks of Fannie and Freddie as a Democratic entity, they were spreading the money around on both sides of the aisle,
absolutely.
Which is the smart way to do it. One of the good parts about the bailout is that we stopped all that lobbying, at least for Fannie and Freddie. We could have done it for the banks and for Wall Street. We'd be a much healthier country. Nobody thought to say, hey, Goldman and Bank of America shouldn't really be in the corridors of power as much as Fannie and Freddie were.
Right.
Stop them both. But hold that aside. Do we need an entity between the buyers and the banks working either with or with the imprimatur of government to keep mortgage rates down? We've seen Europeans don't have this, although they also don't have 30-year fixed mortgages.
Right.
How is this done around the world? We'll make this our last question. How are other mortgages processed, underwritten, regulated elsewhere that might provide an alternative example versus what Fannie and Freddie does?
Well, so what's popular around the world are adjustable rate mortgages. I mean, that's...
Which is not popular here.
That dominates, I think many countries look at us as... This,
so it makes homeowners slaves to interest rate fluctuations.
Very much so. And then on top of it, so countries like Spain, mm-hmm. where you can't walk away from a mortgage.
Ever.
Ever. So
leave the country.
You are tied to that,
right?
And you have to pay it back. There is no get out of jail free card in the mortgage world in countries like Spain.
Wow, that's amazing.
In the U.S.,
isn't half the
in
U.S.
It's a in the U.S. It's basically just a you know it's just another process you go through. It's no big deal.
But there are some states that are recourse states, meaning
yes.
that it's a debt. You could discharge in bankruptcy,
yes.
but you can't just walk away. And then there are non-recourse states where the state, the contract says, in the event that you fail to pay for the house, the bank gets the house, you're done. Which
right.
was always thought of as, oh, okay, I'm not making the payments, I lose the house. That was thought of as a kind of fair trade-off. Nobody expected a million people to do it at once.
Right, an inundation
right.
of it, right. Yeah, the states that are dependent on the court systems were the slowest to recover.
Florida had their own, you know, hyper...
Right.
To try which, by the way, supposedly was a debacle a gnarly mess of corruption and lack of oversight. That in and of itself, I'm sure there's a book in that for whoever wants to sift through it. So really, the countries that don't have GSEs in the middle, the alternative is fluctuating rates. You don't know what your monthly payments are.
It's a different perspective. You know, I'm as you said, I'm not an economist, and I there's a lot of criticism about the effort that it takes to manage a 30-year mortgage, and mm-hmm. we shouldn't be doing that.
But it works so well for so long.
Exactly. So my view of that is, you know, we're questioning home ownership, we're questioning Fannie Mae, and we're questioning 30-year fix. Yet they worked really well until about 10 years ago.
Right.
So why don't we look at what happened 10 years ago and focus on that?
So that was subprime, that was liar loans, that was mass securitization, that was a lack of rating agency accountability. There were a lot of factors
Absolutely.
That caused a functional system to freeze, choke, and spit everything out all at once. Then you think there's a place for the GSEs?
I think there's a place. The way I look at it is, fundamentals of the economy get back on track, most of this stuff goes away. It's just a long, gradual process. I fear that by embedding even more layers of remember, all the regulators were asleep at the switch.
Right.
Everyone.
Sheila Bair may be one of the few exceptions.
And
the same with the woman who was the head of the commodities futures trading.
She actually was... Yeah, she was soundly ignored by Greenspan.
She was chastised by Rubin and Greenspan.
Absolutely. So I agree. Sheila Bair and I can't recall the woman's name, but I saw
Brooks Lee Born. Is that right?
That's it. And they were the ones that sort of the voice of reason. But the balance was they're caught up in it too, and a lot of it they didn't understand it.
The rest of the
Wall Street didn't understand it either.
Right.
You know, the financial engineering. So I don't think the answer is add more. You made the basket. Adding more solves anything. I think
right.
it's let's get back to like fixing the economy first. And a lot of this stuff plays out. It's not that we're going in the right direction. It's just a slow motion ride.
So as the economy goes, so goes real estate.
Absolutely.
Jonathan, I've had you here for 2 hours. Thank you so much for coming in. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure too, Barry.
You know, you and I talk about this stuff all the time, but it's rare when we actually get to sit down for an uninterrupted, meandering conversation about...
I thought the airline discussion was really important, though.
God, let me tell you something. It doesn't take much to set me off. I'm getting better, though. I'm much more present. I read a fascinating study the other day that essentially said the cathartic release of anger does nothing to – some people say, you get it out of your system. It turns out they've done studies and people –
It manifests
who,
it.
It becomes persistent and higher when you – especially when you're driving. So really, I'm trying to learn how to let these slights go and – find a degree of peace. I forgive Delta Airlines for their gross incompetence, and I choose to use my flight. We know you have choices in airlines today. Hell yeah, and that's why I could at least get over my cost with Delta and gratefully fly Virgin.
Well, they're ready
and
when you
Jet
are.
Blue.
So
they apparently weren't. That's the
You're listening to Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
The world needs solutions. On October 24th at the London edition of the Bloomberg Technology Summit, join leaders, innovators, and entrepreneurs to discuss technologies that are poised to solve our most pressing global challenges. From reducing CO2 emissions and making cities more livable, to affordable healthcare and combating food insecurity, executives from Deliveroo, Siemens, Graphcore, and more will examine where tech innovation can take us. Learn more at BloombergLive.com/TechSummit2023.